Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hi there, folks. My name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone, and I also want to welcome my co-hosts, Bobby Neer and Robert. Hi, guys.
Howdy, howdy.
Hello.
Hello, Dave. And today's episode is titled Night of the Meek, and I will turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
This may look to you like any dismal, dark, and dingy alley that lies skulking off the million myriad shadow places off the main drags. Actually, it's the private domain of leprechauns and elves, and supplies the locale of Twilight Zone. With us for a very special occasion is Mr. Art Carney, who plays the role of a department store Santa Claus. And he plays it with the heart, the warmth, and the vast talent that is uniquely Carney. On the Twilight Zone, the Night of the Meek.
Okay, thank you, Robert. And before I begin, I want to welcome Steve Law. And, of course, I want to welcome our good friend Dave from England, also one of our resident guest hosts, or guest co-hosts, I should say, and also Kelly. And I think someone else we just got here. Nope, I guess not. But I would like to welcome you all, and thanks for being here. And also, before I start, I wanted to mention that I've been trying to shorten my episode summaries, you know, condense them a little more so they don't go on too long as they sometimes have in the past, because just about everyone here has seen the episodes, and for anyone who hasn't, well, the summary can and should give the general plot in a short amount of time. So I'm going to try to keep them pretty short, because we all know that a summary should be a brief, concise description of something, not a play-by-play detailed retelling of the story. So you've seen it, you don't need to hear it all again, and I don't want you to get bored. So with that, here is a brief summary of Night of the Meek. Henry Corwin is a street bum whose best friend is the bottom of a bottle. He takes a job as a department store Santa, but gets fired on Christmas Eve when he shows up for work intoxicated. He leaves with his tail between his legs and a broken spirit until he ends up finding a magic sack in an alley. Suddenly, he becomes Santa when he starts pulling gifts out of the sack, and they turn out to be exactly what people in need really want, what the poor and the needy really want. Well, the police come and they arrest him for possessing stolen goods. But when they open the sack, all they find is garbage inside the sack. So they release Henry and he starts passing out gifts again until the sack is empty. After seeing how much joy he's brought to the poor and homeless, he wishes he could do this every Christmas. He walks back through the alley later that night and he's approached by an elf with a sleigh and a reindeer waiting to take him to the North Pole. So his wish was granted. Henry has really become Santa and can spread joy and happiness every holiday season. So that is the brief summary of Night of the Meek. And I think for everyone pretty much has seen that episode who's here. But, you know, at our Twilight Zone group, the ratings at the poll for this episode are all over the place. They range from lousy to average to classic and every rating in between. Now, I gave it an average rating. I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it. This is the only holiday episode of The Twilight Zone that Rod Serling ever wrote. And according to Serling himself in a TV Guide interview, the idea came from watching a Christmas parade with his two kids. He noticed that the man playing Santa on the parade float looked like a last-minute choice because he was very thin and his Santa suit was disheveled, his hair was disheveled. And Serling then realized that perhaps there's an interesting story lurking somewhere in the whole concept of these guys who play Santa for a living. So he started to work on a tale of a fake Santa who suddenly becomes the real thing. But I couldn't give it any higher than an average rating because this episode had one of the most predictable endings of any of the zones that they've done. I think most people knew he was going to become Santa Claus at the end. And the storyline has been copied a few times in the years after Night of the Meek. A thinly veiled copy of the storyline can be seen in the early 90s movie The Santa Claus, starring Tim Allen. So there were no real surprises for me in this one. I knew how it was going to end, and, you know, it was just, it left nothing to my imagination. And, you know, it was obvious, and it just didn't blow me away. All of the acting was good, though. I think Serling's casting of R. Carney in the role was right on the mark. The man is a terrific actor, and I've loved his work ever since his role as Ed Norton in The Honeymooners. In fact, this Zone episode reunited Serling and R. Carney and the director, Jack Smite, because Carney starred in one of Rod Serling's Playhouse 90 episodes called The Velvet Alley, which Jack Smite directed. And I do believe that the Playhouse 90 episode was a, I guess, sort of a vague story of Serling himself. When Rod Serling wrote it, he was kind of writing it about himself because it is about a writer. One other little piece of trivia. I think everybody or a lot of people know that A Nightmare as a Child, that episode that was from season one, starring Janice Rule. Well, Janice Rule's character was named after his favorite teacher, Helen Foley. Well, in this episode, R. Carney's character, Henry Corwin, was named after Rod Serling's idol, writer Norman Corwin. So that's just a little extra trivia to throw out there. And so, as I said, I gave it an average rating, and with that, I'll turn it over to Robert.
So, Henry didn't go on to work in the sewers. Oh, no, that's a different show. Okay. Yeah, I noticed the ratings for this one was kind of a mixed bag as well. What kind of puzzles me is this show's kind of a mystery in a sense of why do we only do one Christmas show out of five seasons and that's it. You know, this felt more of a season one than it did a season two episode. Maybe it wasn't popular enough to where they didn't have a season one every year. I think they should have tried to do one every year, to be honest about it. It's kind of weird just to throw, you know, something in there and say, well, that's it, and then, you know, don't go back to it again. I guess it's like season four. But anyway, it was okay. I mean, I remember this when I was a kid. I kind of gave it a good rating because I thought I could do much better than the bum R. Carney could in this one. When I was a kid, you know, shoot, you know, he becomes Santa. Why heck God be Santa? But yeah, this one kind of had the memory in mind for me. You know, I agree. It is kind of a one or two, but you know, it tugs at my heartstring a little bit when I watch it. And here I'm coming from the stance of, well, you know, I never seen it originally because, last year the Twilight Zone was when I was born. So, the only things I have to go on is reference to other things that I've seen. What's interesting too is that I ain't going to go into the whole detail too, like Lynn was saying about the whole story. I mean, we've seen it, we pretty much know what it's about. So I decided to do a comparison to the 1985 version. Yes, folks, there was a remake of Night of the Meek in 1985 when they revived Twilight Zone, and it had Richard Mulligan in it as Henry. In that one, it kind of followed along the same line as the original one, but they did have some variances in the story in the 85 version. I noticed that the thing about Sister Florence and the mission where Henry goes to give out the presents there, and then she goes and runs to the police through, you know, the Officer Flaherty to talk about the stuff that Henry was passing out as Santa. In the 85 version, that one was cut out. And in the 85 version, it's pretty much Henry is in his apartment. After hearing carolers sing outside his window, he takes the trash out and notices that the trash bag, not the burlap sack in the original one, but the trash bag was giving out gifts. And so instead of the mission situation in the original, then he goes on to pass out the presents in his apartment. And Mr. Dundee character is in this one as well. He is the owner of the store. He's riding home. He finds, he's wondering what all the commotion was and stops at Henry's apartment. So we also have the police situation. He doesn't go to jail in 85-1. The police come there. And the scene that I'm going to play next from the 85 is where after all of what's happened in Henry's life, they're sitting outside the steps. We remember the original one. It was the old man that comes out with his pipe as the present that he got from Henry and sitting on the steps and asking him a question about what you know, why didn't he get what he wanted? Well, the 85 version, you have Mr. Dundee asking that question.
These gifts didn't come from your store. We both know that.
Then where?
Never question miracles.
That's the coat.
That's my wife's coat.
It's something for you.
Mickey Mantle. Roger Maris.
Are these autographs real?
I bet they are.
These are all the 61 Yankees?
Corwin. What about you?
You want nothing for yourself?
This night was my gift. And I couldn't have received anything more perfect. Unless you would be
to live this magic every year.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Dundee!
Kind of get the difference in ending in the 85 than we get from the 1960 version. Little girl elf that appears in the 60 version is missing from this one. Basically, we see the magic at the end to where the reference of the Santa Claus is brought up from Lynn, where he actually turns into Santa Claus and goes up the chimney in the 85 version. That's kind of how they ended that one. If you break this down, it's almost like a genie in the bottle situation again, as Bobby referred to in other stories, where you have a wish or a thought and Santa grabs it out of the bag and there it is. One of the things I focused on, I haven't put my review up yet, but I'm going to put it up later on here, is Santa himself. How does Santa carry on from the centuries? And it's kind of an interesting thought. You know, Santa and Mrs. Claus, they have children. Is the heritage passed on to the child itself? Or just simply, if something happens to Santa, it's almost like Doctor Who. If something happens to Santa, does someone else take his place situation with this? And a couple of clips that I got. One is, as Lynn mentioned, Santa Claus, Tim Allen's first movie, a real good first movie at that, because it pretty much set Tim Allen in the movies for later on, doing Toy Story and other movies. So here's the trailer for that.
Dad, you're the clatter.
Somebody's on the roof.
Maybe it's Santa.
Not now, Charlie.
This Christmas, Scott Calvin's getting into the spirit the only way he can.
Hey, you!
By accident.
If something should happen to me, put on my suit, the reindeer will know what to do.
Santa! Killed him!
Did not.
Check out Santa's sleigh!
When you put on the suit, you felt subject to the Santa Claus.
The Santa Claus?
What does that mean? It means you put on the suit, you're the big guy.
Ha! Santa? Tucking your clothes is so baggy.
Do you want this doll or not? Go back to sleep. I shave in the morning, in the afternoon, I look like this.
Oh, my God.
Calvin, you wait.
What happened?
Bee sting.
What, you put on a little weight?
Does this look like a little weight to you?
You look distressed.
I'm way past distressed.
I'm talking to an elf.
He's not Santa.
Oh, my God.
He is too Santa.
Wait, I'm not done.
Fax me.
This is our perpetrator. This one's not going to be easy to find.
Won't the bright red suit and beard give him away?
Who's down there?
Santa, your father this year.
Have a piece of fruit, for God's sake.
This holiday season...
It's coming!
Tim Allen is giving... Till It Hurts.
Johnny, naughty. Gary, nice. Veronica, very nice.
The Santa Claus.
You're a 1,200-year-old elf?
You look pretty good for your age.
Thanks, but I'm seeing someone in wrapping.
If anybody's seen the Santa Claus, you see your Tim Allen mouth okay after that. But wonderful movie, one of my favorites during the Christmas season. One of the best I think Tim Allen did. Also, how did Santa come to be? And there was a movie that tried to attempt that. It was Santa Claus the Movie, came out in 1985. And we get to hear a Twilight Zone alumni, Burgess Meredith, in the beginning of this one. So here's that trailer for that one.
Prophecy has come to pass that there would come to us a chosen one, and that he himself would be an artist and a skilled maker of toys. From this day on, now and forever, you will bring our gifts to all the children in all the world. This is your legacy and your gift, as is the gift of fright.
It's them!
Every year, the magic happens again.
Merry Christmas!
It certainly should be.
Until now.
Look, how are you?
I'm an elf.
An elf?
Yes.
You mean, like, a fairy?
I mean, I'm talking modern methods of production here. I'm talking assembly line. I'm talking way for the future.
Now someone wants to take the magic out of Christmas.
We say, bigger, better.
It's going to cost you.
Cost who?
The people who buy the toy.
For nothing. We're going to give them away free.
For free?
Well, that's how we do it at the North Pole.
Well, that's not how we do it here.
Santa Claus is finished.
I just wanted him to see what a good assistant I could be.
Only one man can stop him. Only one man can help us. And he's coming to take you for a sleigh ride in the sky. Alexander Salkind presents... Dudley Moore and John Lithgow. The legend comes to life for the very first time. With all the magic, all the adventure, all the wonder. Santa Claus, the movie. Seeing is believing.
With that one, also, John Lithgow played the third segment in the Twilight Zone movie. He played the William Shatner role in that one. Yeah, this one tried to tell the history of Santa Claus, from being a wood carver to finding the North Pole. And John Lithgow was kind of the over-the-top villain in that movie, but here again, there were some examples of Santa Claus himself. And as I said earlier, kind of a genie in a bottle type formula situation, except for sack. So there's my little clip I threw in for you there, Bobby, to pass over there, since I know you're a Yankees fan. So I'll go ahead and pass it over to you.
Thank you very much, Robert. Well, there's only one thing I can say after all these touchy-feely remarks on the board and everywhere about this episode and how sweet it is and how nice it is, and that is bah humbug. I don't like it at all. I never did. Yes, that's a good one, yeah. I never did like it. It doesn't do a thing for me, and there's just nothing there. I mean, anybody could have written it. It's not, you know, outstanding writing in it, and Lynn is certainly right when she indicates that you can predict what's going to happen from the minute it starts. Anytime you see a character, especially dressed as Santa, who's lurching around as a drunk, you can certainly predict that he will be redeemed at the end by Christmas spirit, because people watching at home did not want to see it any other way. So you know how it's going to end. You may not know that he's going to turn into actual Santa Claus, but you can pretty much see where it's going. So this story just doesn't do anything for me. It's not the worst episode of the series. We still have some of those in front of us, unfortunately. But I think what really hurts for me right now is that it's one of a succession of really poor stories in season two that seem to be endless. Started out back a month or so ago with that one with Inger Stevens about being a robot. And we had that. We had the guy with the radio last time. And we had the one with the idiots with the camera. And now we've got this. And it just goes from week to week. It surprises me that the Twilight Zone managed to survive this really kind of dip in the road here, because in these four stories, I don't see anything that even looks like the Twilight Zone.
And the video didn't help neither, did it, Bobby?
What didn't help?
The look didn't help at all.
Oh, no, not at all. No. And I just think I wonder if you could get away with that today on TV, where things come and go in a heartbeat. If you don't go from week to week and grab everybody, they'll pull you out of there in a minute. So certainly kind of lucky.
Well, you know, it didn't grab everybody back then, Bob. I thought it was a good episode. Not great, not awful.
Right.
But I thought it was pretty good. If I can chime in, I'm sorry, by the way.
That's all right. No, that's fine.
That's
not my type of story. So I don't have a whole lot to say about it, but I did find some interesting things about Art Carney. Now, of course, everybody knows about Art Carney being in The Honeymooners. And in fact, if you go to IMDb, there's a lot of information about Art Carney. And Jackie Gleason says on there that, or said at the time, that he was 90% of the reason why The Honeymooners was a success. And I don't doubt that. And but there's some interesting things. Now, in this story, he plays a down-and-out alcoholic who's trying to be Santa Claus. But and I didn't know this. Maybe everybody does but me. But Art Carney actually was an alcoholic at one time. It says here in IMDb, yeah. he was the original Felix in The Odd Couple on Broadway, and he had to leave the show because he suffered a nervous breakdown over the end of his 25-year marriage to wife Joan due to his addictions to alcohol, amphetamines, and barbiturates. And he recovered in the 70s, and he of course won an Oscar for Harry and Tano, and then they got remarried. So it's a remarkable story, but. Now, my question would be, since this, when is this episode, Lynn? Was it 60?
60,
yeah.
So 5 years later, I seriously doubt that he suddenly became addicted to all these things just because he had marital problems. So maybe, because it says here, due to his addictions, he may have had this as a longstanding thing. So
actually, Bobby, I don't doubt the alcoholism, but some of the other, the drug, okay, let me back up a little bit. A lot of us in the business think that the IMDb is the idiot's movie database.
Well, thank you. I've never been so complimented. Thank you.
Because there's a lot of inaccuracies. There's a lot of home movies on it that never went anywhere. A lot of the quote-unquote details of people are not true. As a matter of fact, at one point, I think Spielberg wanted to sue them for something. So a lot of us take what the IMDb says about people with a grain of salt.
Well,
the alcoholism, maybe, but the others, like I said, I'm not sure.
Well, I don't doubt that. There's a lot on the internet that you can't believe, so that doesn't surprise me in the least.
Right.
But at any rate, whether he was able to portray an alcoholic because he wasn't one in real life or he just did a good job or because he was a good actor is, you know, who knows? I don't know which way it was. But I
you can talk about Charlie Sheen like that too, Bobby.
Well, I got a reverse thing.
What's that?
You guys have heard of Jason Robards.
Heard of what?
Jason Robards, the actor.
Oh, Jason
Robards.
Okay. One of his sons from his first wife is my best friend. I've known him since I was like 13. He was an alcoholic and you could never tell with his acting, but yet on almost every movie, he was drunk.
That doesn't surprise me. There are actors who are able to do that, overcome their addictions. That wouldn't be, I thought Charlie Sheen was very good in Wall Street and
definitely.
And yet he's a lunatic. So I mean, it doesn't. You know, sometimes they're able to put that aside.
Or even Robert Downey Jr. I mean, the case is over the place.
Yeah.
Bobby, go ahead and finish up here. Go ahead, Bobby.
Other thing I found at IMDb, and of course this might be a lot of BS too, is that Art Carney was such a great voiceover artist. He did voiceovers for a lot of things. That he actually during his fireside chats, Franklin Roosevelt was too ill. It was Art Carney imitating his voice instead, and nobody even knew it. Now, I don't know whether they made this up or not. That's the first time I've ever heard about it. It says here he was such a talented voice artist that he sometimes substituted for President Franklin Roosevelt in his famous fireside chats when Roosevelt was too ill to speak. So, and I didn't really know that Carney was known so much for his voice. So that's another thing that's there.
Whether I didn't know that
I've never heard that. So now that I've heard it. that only idiots look at IMDb. I don't know. No.
I didn't say no. I didn't say only idiots. I said that that's what we call it in the business. That's all I said.
Anyway.
I said we call it the idiot movie database. I didn't say people that work there are.
Okay, well, maybe they should change the name, just keep the letters the same. Anyway, as far as the episode is concerned, it's always fun to see Art Carney. Harry and Tano, I've only seen once. I haven't seen it in years, so I don't even remember it. He actually won an Oscar for that. He beat out Jack Nicholson, Dustin Hoffman, and Al Pacino that year. He beat out Al Pacino for The Godfather, too. So, I mean, that's quite impressive. There's no doubt about the man's talent. But that's another thing that bothers me about this story, is that if you're going to have Art Carney in it, or any famous actor or comic or anybody, I would think you would do a better story. I don't think it shows him at his best. I don't want to sit for 23 minutes watching him just lurching around, sitting at a bar. That's kind of poor. I would expect more than that. So, basically, story doesn't do much for me. Is it the worst? No, I gave it a 1. Lately, as everybody knows, I've been giving a lot of things 0. So I would give it a 1, probably mainly because he's in it more than for any other reason. There are worse things. We got one coming up soon that's absolutely dreadful. So, it could be better, it could be worse. Lynn tells me somebody in our poll section called it a classic, which I find absolutely astonishing.
Two people
rated it as classic. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's a classic, I sure would like to know what time enough of this is. So
I think some people might consider it a classic because it was the only Christmas episode that Sterling ever did. So they might.
No,
think
that's not
that
the
make
best
classic
because
that's,
it's the only
that's
one.
That's not
well,
true.
Yeah, that's not true.
There's a couple.
Yeah, well, see, I would have just thought maybe because they figured that's the only Twilight Zone episode that was ever Christmas related or holiday related, so they voted classic for that, but I don't know if that's true, but, that's what I would think.
I would love to make it a classic, but it fell short for me. It's a leap to make it a 3.
Yeah. I made an average just because the ending was so predictable. Oh, by the way, I'd like to welcome Eiffel and guest number 12, and, of course, Rick Wall. Welcome to everybody who's here. And so, Bobby, anything else to add on that?
Yeah, I was just going to say I watched it at the beginning of the week for the first time in many, many years. And although I got through it, I didn't like it. And it's the only thing now that can make me look back upon the Oscar awards on TV several weeks ago with fondness. That actually was more fascinating than this is, only because it was so dreadfully bad and almost funny. That's it for me, Lynn.
Okay. And now we're going to turn it over to Dave.
Not a lot to say on this one, but I probably agree more with Bobby on this one than I have on any of the other episodes recently.
Well,
I'm not really
someday at the Idiots database. We can look through it together.
I'm not really fond of these Christmas specials. Robert will know I'm not really keen in when they do the Christmas specials. Because they spend, not in this case, but in that, they spend a lot of extra money on it, and they seem to sort of hold back money from standard episodes so they can have a lavish Christmas one, and I'd much rather have a decent budget given to the series as a whole. The only thing I would say when Lynn were mentioning about how it's been done to death, this idea in a way, I do fairly strongly feel that when you're watching something that was made in 1960, you sort of can't downgrade it, because that idea was reused in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and whatever, because the people making it at the time had no, foreknowledge of those, repetitions that then weaken any plot. I'm not necessarily saying that this plot was weakened by it, because it was such a sort of cosy, homely, Christmassy type of plot, but I do always feel as though you've got to think that anything that happened after an episode aired can't be used necessarily to criticise the episode. You can always say, well, it was done better in 1970, or it was done better when it was revisited 10 years later. But you can't sort of criticise the people for not knowing that it was going to be done better 10 years later, if that makes sense. Art Carney apparently played Santa again in 1984 in a TV movie, The Night They Saved Christmas. Thought that was a little bit interesting. The blonde at the bar, there was very brief appearance and I don't think she spoke, Nan Peterson, was in 4 Twilight Zone. So she's somewhat of a record, well, not a record, but obviously had a little bit of a thing going there. But the person I'd really like to talk about is the chap who played Mr. Dundee, the John Friedler, is it? I remember him from 12 Angry Men, which apparently I hadn't realised was one of his first roles, and that was, I think that was 1957, prior to this one. So, and I thought he was excellent in that.
He was also in Star Trek Original, too.
He was in Star Trek Original, as was Meg Wiley, the lady who played Sister Florence. She was in the very first episode, The Cage. But John Friedler was also...
He did a lot of character acting. He was a great character actor.
He was the voice of Piglet from Winnie the Pooh. And he was in a lot of Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, Tigger the Movie. And so, and again, I'm not knowledgeable on this. I am reading from Wiki and assuming that it is, for this instance, correct. So not a lot really to say, except to say that I did, when I was catching this up, by accident, watch the middle section, and it turned out to be the remake, the 1980s remake, which I didn't think was as good. And one thing about that, which I ought to mention, is the chap who played Mr. Dundee in that was played by William Alterton, I think that's how you pronounce his name, who actually I thought is a reasonably good actor from films I've seen him in. I remember him, he played the reporter in the Die Hard movies, the one that was the Pratt on the aeroplane that was always trying to get him in trouble. And he was in the Pelican Brief and even in Ghostbusters and quite a number of films. But if you were watching his acting in this, you wouldn't have thought he would have such an illustrious career ahead of him, because as Mr. Dundee, he certainly wasn't as good as the John Friedler character in the early movie. So not a lot to say. I'm not really a great fan of Christmas Present. It was adequate. And I'm vying between giving it 1 or 2 points. Probably 2 points, because it was not harmful. But again, I'm going to finish on agreeing with Bobby, because I want to cheer the guy up. I agree with him. Up to now, Series 2 does seem to be a watered-down series.
Okay.
I think Series 3 starts picking up. That seems to be where they hit their stride.
But what I mean by watered down, I mean, not many of them have packed a real punch. There's been the twist in the tail, but there's not been anything really hard-hitting.
Earth-shattering, yeah.
Right, right. Well, thank you for that, Dave. And our former co-host, Kelly, is here, and I know she wants to give her thoughts. So, Kelly, hi there.
Hello. Yes, and I want to say hello to the new members that have joined our Twilight Zone group on the Internet. This is your other co-moderator, Kelly, talking. And I just want to start off by saying I am the dissenting voice here, because I disagree with pretty much everybody about this episode. I did not rank it a classic. I gave it I believe I gave it a 4 for excellent, because I really couldn't find a lot to dislike about it. I would put this episode into a category that I tend to refer to as one of the lighter fare episodes. And I do agree that when we get these episodes that are kind of more to be a little bit lighter, maybe have more humor in them, I think so far most of them have not been all that great. But I really did not mind this. I thought Art Carney was very touching in this role. I felt a lot of empathy for him. The one thing about his character, Henry, it would have been nice if we could have found out a little bit more about Henry. I would have been curious to know how it was Henry ended up where he was. You know, what, obviously something happened in his life to put him into this situation of being alcoholic and down on his luck. But it was clearly, obviously, he liked kids, you know, and you kind of had to, I kind of found myself wondering, did this man lose his family at some point? Is this why he ended up like this?
It's missing a backstory, I agree.
Yeah, and it's, you know, because certainly he was, you know, he does not come across as necessarily a bad person. He certainly doesn't seek out to mess up. He legitimately felt badly when he got fired from his job, And some of the scenes in there I thought were very good. Because there was the scene where the mother calls to the manager and says the guy is drunk, and she starts saying all kinds of stuff that he was rude, and he said, and he actually sticks up for himself and he says, I was not rude to this woman. Now, you want to fire me for insubordination because I was late coming back to work, fair enough, but let the record show I was not rude to that customer. And I just, you know, and I liked John, I did like John Fiedler a lot as Dundee. Pretty much anything I've ever seen him in, I've always enjoyed him. I've seen him in several things from that era, and he's always a wonderful actor to see. Just because he's such an unassuming and soft-spoken guy, you're just not really sure what's going to happen with him. But he's a very good character actor. I liked the scene at the police station. I thought it was very cute when they, you know, when Dundee comes in there and wants to file charges against him for stealing, but of course they just find garbage. And one of the bits in there that I thought was great was when he opened up the sack and the cat jumped out. I mean, it was a nice little play on the cats out of the bag. I thought that was just priceless. And the look on John Fiedler's face when Henry asks him, what is it that you would like? And he says, okay, fine. I'd like a bottle of 1903 cherry brandy. And he reaches in there and he grabs it and he hands it to him and wishes him a Merry Christmas. And I thought that bit was great. The look on John Fiedler's face and the other cop in the police precinct was great, and they decide they're going to open up that bottle of brandy and get hammered with it on Christmas Eve. I thought that was very good. And I also do disagree a little bit in the predictability of the ending, because we have seen other episodes that kind of hint that this could have gone a different way. For example, in season one, you had that episode called The Stop at Willoughby, where you have the James Daly character who is getting off the train and he's walking into this pristine, serene place. And at the end of the, at the end of the show, you find him in the snow dead. Well, that could have just as easily happened in this episode. I mean, this was not a show that aired during the family hour. I know that Rod Serling got some nasty letters from some parents saying that they were very angry that he had portrayed a Santa Claus as a drunk. But by the same token, this is a show that aired at 10 p.m., so I doubt very much that there were very many little kids who watched that show and got traumatized by it. But because this show aired at 10 p.m. on a Friday night, he could have easily taken a much darker ending to this. I mean, we could have had it where the whole thing at the end happened, and it was Henry's hallucination as he was dying. We could have seen him at the end drunk or basically dead in the alley, as they were finding his body. But in his mind, you know, he has ascended and he's now living the life that he wants to. But in reality, for the rest of the world, Henry actually died in the alley. So certainly, we could have seen a much darker ending. And I think it's good that we had a nicer ending, because after all, it's Christmas. Who wants to get really depressed?
Yeah, I couldn't see Rod Serling killing off, even if it wasn't not in Family Hour. I couldn't see him killing off Santa or somebody playing Santa 2 days before Christmas.
You know what? Certainly that was an option, and it wouldn't surprise me if Rod Serling actually thought of the idea and then thought, nah, we can't do that. But you know, in today's world, who's to say somebody wouldn't write something like that? You could, you know, the sky's the limit. After all, it's the Twilight Zone.
Well, we got to remember, we had that Miracle on 34th Street, the original one, where the Santa was drunk in the Macy's Christmas parade, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
They fired on
I thought it was good. There was really nothing for me to dislike in it. I mean, okay, it was kind of predictable, but I thought the overall message was good. I liked the positive aspect of it, and we don't get to see we don't really get to see a nice ending very often in the Twilight Zone, so I figure, what, you know, why not enjoy it? And actually, we did have one other one that sort of was Christmas-oriented, but you don't find out it's Christmas-oriented till the very, very end of the episode. That was from Season 3, Five Characters in Search of an Exit, when you find out at the end.
Well, yeah, that was the very last.
But they're actually toys for a Christmas toy drive. But you don't find that out till the last 5 minutes of the episode. So that was the only other time that you actually see them delve into a holiday. And I suspect the reason why we only saw one holiday episode was because after this, showing Santa Claus, you know, what can you really follow it with? I mean, I suppose, you know, you could have taken pretty much any other episode that they did and set it at Christmas time, but I don't know that it would have really had the same effect. So it's kind of a nice little standalone episode, and I think I was good. Like I said, I gave it an excellent rating. So that's pretty much all I have to say on it.
Not everyone I'm rewatching it. Go ahead, Rickroll. Sorry.
I said not everybody disagrees with you. I forgot to give my rating. Can we give half points?
Sure.
Like,
go ahead.
Like 4.5?
We just recently added that to the rating system, 4.5.
Okay.
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Okay,
yes,
that's
yes,
my
can.
Rating for this episode.
That's certainly entitled to that. You're entitled to that opinion. Oh, I'd like to welcome Felix in New Jersey. Welcome, Felix. Oh, you know, you're certainly entitled to that opinion. You're not alone. I mean, there were people who gave it classic, good, excellent. I mean, it ran the gamut. It really did. You know, it was one of those ones that it was all over the board.
And that's actually, I think, a good thing. I mean, if everybody always holds the same opinion, that's kind of dull. You know, the conversation stops early on the board when that happens.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
I mean,
so anybody else?
It was an attempt, which was too bad that, as Kelly was saying, that they didn't do one each year. I think it would have been nice if they tried to do one each year, but it kind of felt out of place in the second season. This felt more like a season one where this one should have been placed. I mean, it was written by Sterling, so.
Yeah, that's true. Well, as I told you in my review there, this came out of the blue. You know, he's watching a parade with his kids, and this totally un-Santa-like person is on the Santa float, you know, very thin, very disheveled, and he just said, well, you know, this looks like somebody they just grabbed at the last minute because the original Santa couldn't make it, and, you know, he's thinking there's got to be a story behind these guys, you know, that do these jobs, and that's how the story came about. So, you know, it was pretty interesting how he comes up with these ideas. He just sees something, and there it is, you know, there's a new Twilight Zone. So I thought that was pretty cool.
I would recommend everybody to check out the 85 version just for giggles,
well,
see the difference.
Does anybody know why the 85 version was made?
No.
Well, it was made in season 2.
Why it was made.
Well, why, yeah. I have no idea.
Okay.
Season 1, episode 13A.
So. Harlan Ellison wanted to put in a story called Knuckles. Where Knuckles is Santa's brother. He hates Christmas. He has a sleigh propelled by bulls. And instead of gifts, he goes down and kills people.
Oh, geez.
So the network said no. Absolutely not. We can't put a Christmas episode on where Santa Claus kills people.
Wonder why.
That's when Harlan got pissed off, as he usually does, especially at people with on TV, and said, you know what? I was a producer of this piece of garbage. From now on, take my name off of it. I'm not doing a damn thing with it. Goodbye.
Wow.
I think it was just something Rick Waldie wanted to throw in because we remember the 85 version.
They had nothing else to do, so you're right. They threw it in,
right?
Because they you know, they had shot about 60% of the Knuckles episode.
Well, let me explain that. It's one of three of that episode. It was episode 13A, which ran 22 minutes, 18 seconds. And then they had But She Can Type, and there was another one that went in with that. And it aired December 20th, 1985.
Right.
So they thought, well, we need to throw a Christmas one in. We'll grab one from 1960.
No. Again, I repeat, no. That's why they redid it, yes. But, like I said, they had shot and done a lot of the Knuckles episode, and then the network comes in and says, no, you're not showing this. We're not showing this with this episode. So the other producers caved and said, okay, we'll cut it out. And then they go, great, what do we do now? And somebody said, well, let's remake the this one, and they did.
Like I said, I give it 2 out of 5 for the 85. It was okay.
Well, if it,
I would think
actually,
Art Carney would be better.
I mean, I would say the original one rates better to me than the remake, so perhaps I ought to go firmly to 2, not between 1 and 2.
I would think Art Carney would be, you know, a little... I mean, I like Richard Mulligan, don't get me wrong, but I guess I like Art Carney a little better, and, you know, I think he's better for this episode.
And it's too bad it's the only one he did, too, Lynn. It would have been nice seeing him in some other episodes.
Yeah, because you know Rod Serling, you know, he had a thing about using the same actors over and over again in his episodes. You know, even the character actors, even the ones who weren't stars. You
Jack
know,
Klugman, Burgess Meredith, I mean, you know.
Exactly.
Line goes on.
Well,
yeah.
That's because Burgess and him were friends, and Burgess actually did not get paid for a lot of them. He's volunteered to do a lot of them.
You know, I read that before.
Friendship
that's true.
With him.
That's true.
A lot of the actors at that time did so. I think Klugman
did it
was
out of
one. Yep.
Yeah, I read that somewhere too. But also some of the character actors they use because that woman in The Fever, Vivi Janis, who plays the wife of the husband who can't take the gambling. You know, he can't stand gambling, but then he gets addicted to the machine. Vivi Janis.
The Fever.
Fever. Right. She was in about 2 or 3 episodes. And she played basically character parts in the other ones. And there's also the one guy, Penny for Your Thoughts. Penny for Your Thoughts, the guy who plays the banker who they think is going to, you know, steal money from the bank. I forget his name now, but he's an old character actor. And he played in about 3 or 4 of the Twilight Zone episodes, but basically in, you know, supporting parts. So, yeah, Rod Serling did like to use his actors over and over again.
Mm-hmm. We had Dick York in a couple. We had Ingrid Stieglitz in a couple.
Yeah.
He says in chat, William Chapner. Yeah. So.
Exactly. And even the guy who played the sailor and the hitchhiker was just in The Most Unusual Camera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the guy who played the brother. Woodrow. That's it, Woodrow. He played the sailor and the hitchhiker. Yeah, he did like to use his people more than once. If he liked you, you had a job. So, anybody else?
Lynn, I'd like to add something.
Sure.
I'd like to make a formal invitation to any other idiots out there listening to this show to join me at IMDb anytime because I spend a lot of my time there. I'll see them there because I always say you can never be too misinformed.
He's not going to let you live this down, Rick. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
That's go to my class reunion this year, or actually school reunion. I'm going to probably be pelted with, Rick, what does the NRA stand for? National Recovery Act? Because in a history paper in high school, I put National Rifle Association wrong.
I was thinking that.
I put the wrong Roosevelt. I mean, yeah, the wrong thing with the wrong Roosevelt. And my history teacher was like, what?
I guess Franklin and Teddy can get confusing there.
Yeah.
Is this
a job application for IMDb? Then is it?
And he is now the headmaster. So
well, there you go.
Yeah, I think we.
Yeah,
so
I think we should wrap up the show. It's getting to be as long as
Titanic
was.
Else has anything to add. I guess we're done now. We will be back in 2 weeks. Robert, what's our next episode?
It will be Dust, the 26th.
Fest on the 26th of March. Okay. So we will see everyone in 2 weeks, and that will be March 26th for Dust. I hope to see you all there. And we are wrapping this one up, so have a great weekend, everybody. See ya.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
And we'll finish up with Rod here.
A word to the wise to all the children of the 20th century, whether their concern be pediatrics or geriatrics, whether they crawl on hands and knees and wear diapers, or walk with a cane and comb their beards. There's a wondrous magic to Christmas, and there's a special power reserved for little people. In short, there's nothing mightier than the meek.